Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon and welcome to FedSoc Forums. I'm Alex Zenos, Practice Groups Fellow at the Federalist Society. Today's Courthouse Steps program will be a discussion of the recent unanimous decision from the Supreme Court, HICWA v. Ameren. Joining us to discuss this decision, we have Professor Adam Massoff, Professor of Law at Antonin Scalia Law School of George Mason University, and Wesley Weeks, Partner at Wiley Rain LLP. A couple of notes before we begin. As always, the Federalist Society does not take policy positions, and all views expressed in this session belong to our speakers. Towards the end of the program, we'll take questions from the audience. So if you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen, not the chat. And with that, I will turn things over to our speakers to start today's conversation.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining. We're going to jump right into it. The case today we're discussing is HICWA versus Ameren. It's one of the, in a long line of cases, the Supreme Court has been taking on patent doctrine issues. And this is the most recent one just out. It is a case about induced infringement. So direct infringement is where you infringe the patent yourself. Induced infringement is where you're not directly practicing what the patent claims, but you've done something to encourage, or in the law, the words of the law, you've induced someone else to infringe. And it's a form of secondary liability. So you have a liability as the person who has induced the infringement. This case specifically arises out of the interesting world of generic drugs under the Hatch-Waxman Act, where generic drugs apply for FDA approval and use mostly the same labeling as the branded drug, but the FDA regulations allow you to carve out specific portions of a label if it does not relate to safety and efficacy. And so it's very common for a generic applicant to try to carve out a patented indication. So let's say the drug is approved for treatment of heart attacks or prevention of heart attacks and prevention of stroke. Maybe there's a patent on the prevention of stroke use and not on heart attacks. So you try to have your label say, our product's approved for the treatment of only the unpatented or non-patented indication. That's basically what this case was. The generic here, HICMA, had carved out one of the indications, and then at the pleading stage, the patent owner had pled induced infringement for methods of use claims, and the HICMA moved to dismiss, which was granted by the district court on the grounds that they did not actually induce infringement. That goes to the Federal Circuit, who reverses. Under their lines of cases going back to 2011, at least GSK, the GSK cases, and the Supreme Court takes the case and reverses in a relatively short opinion that purports to be applying, you know, the Supreme Court's doctrine on induced infringement, saying you need there are three elements. There has to be someone who's actually directly infringing the patent. There has to be knowledge of the infringing use, or knowledge that there are acts that constitute infringement. And then the third element is the one that's at issue here. There have to be active steps or active inducement of the infringement. And one by one, the Supreme Court basically says everything that a brand would normally rely on in this sort of context of an attempted carve out of the label doesn't count. It doesn't count if you're AB rated. That means your product's deemed to be equivalent, therapeutically equivalent to the brand product, and can be substituted by the pharmacist for not just the non-infringing use that you sought approval for, but for any use. And often the patented use will be the greater proportion of the revenue. So the generic will know that they are going to be receiving most of their revenue from the patented use. That knowledge is deemed non-sufficient. Press releases citing the revenue that will come from the patented use is not sufficient. Omissions are not sufficient. Anything in the label that the FDA required to be in there, so clinical trial data, the FDA will not let you carve that out generally if it's deemed important for doctors to have access to it to understand how to use the drug safely and effectively. The Supreme Court says that's out. What they've left is a category of implicit inducement. They rejected Hikma's argument that inducement has the intent element has to be expressed. It can still be implicit. What that means in this context is sort of anyone's guess. I'm sure Adam has some opinions on that as well. And so, you know, the case is now remanded and we'll see where it goes. But I think just to put this in context, and then I'll turn it over to Adam, is I see this case as just the most recent data point in kind of a pattern where the Supreme Court has taken many patent cases. And Adam might put this a little different than me, but the way I see it is there's sort of two categories. There's ones that involve either, you know, poor patent law or evidentiary trial issues like, you know, what's the standard for attorney's fees? You know, what type of evidence do you need to show obviousness, where the Supreme Court unanimously usually reverses the Federal Circuit in what is a more like holistic, pragmatic approach to these areas than what the Federal Circuit applies. So these are cases like KSR and others. But even in cases where the Supreme Court has affirmed the Federal Circuit unanimously, like in the Amgen's Sanofi case from a year or two ago, it's still taking what the Federal Circuit does and applying a much more holistic common sense. I don't have a great word for it, but a much more just sort of higher level, you know it when you see it kind of approach to areas of law that have a lot of doctrinal development in the Federal Circuit and district court. And then there's a whole other class of cases like oil states and other ones that arise from patent cases, but involve things like separation of powers, due process rights. Those tend to actually be highly contested at the Supreme Court, result in split or divided opinions. But this case is firmly in that first category, I think, of cases where the Supreme Court took the case to unanimously tell the Federal Circuit, we don't like what you're doing with patent doctrine. And with that, I'll turn it over to Adam.
Thank you, Wes. Yes. Well, clearly the Supreme Court does not like what the Federal Circuit does. June 4th was, I woke up that day and I felt very much like this is for people who do patent law and work in patent policy. Like it was very much like Groundhog Day. I think I actually woke up to Sonny and Cher singing I Got You, Babe on my phone, my alarm clock, because it was another day where the Supreme Court handed down a decision where either they reversed the Federal Circuit or patent owners lost, or both. I mean, in this, I think there's like 48 now cases, maybe 49 since 2006 in the patents and patent law that Supreme Court has decided, and patent owners have lost in all of them except for maybe one or two. This was another one. And I think Wes is onto something when he talks about kind of these unanimous opinions that are relatively short. You know, Justice Scalia once said that, you know, that he says the worst opinions by the court are these unanimous opinions, because there's no one there in the court holding their fellow colleagues' feet to the fire about this, you know, the rigor of their arguments, whether they're really getting the doctrine right or wrong and things of this sort. And so it's really notable that, you know, all this whole series of decisions, Wes mentioned KSR, unanimous, short, eBay, unanimous, short, Alice, unanimous, short, now Hikma, unanimous, short, and Cox in the copyright space, also unanimous and short, where they upend existing doctrine, a significant amount of it, oftentimes sub silentio without even talking about it, and or citing cases, claiming the cases say something which they really don't, and so it's very frustrating, and it leaves a lot of open questions. And I think that this case clearly continues in that tradition. I think Wes very succinctly described in a very, what is a very complex case. Although everyone keeps talking about this case as a skinny labeling case, it's not a skinny labeling case. It's an inducement case. It's, I mean, in fact, they stopped talking about skinny labeling, skinny labels after, you know, after the procedural posture and the kind of talking about the facts and do their analysis. It's all about inducement. And so it goes far beyond skinny labeling, because, and they're handing down an holding that is about inducement and proving inducement. Moreover, it's a very different type of procedural posture from prior inducement cases like Global Tech, and even Grokster, which they talk about at length, which is, those are all cases that were litigated to final decision. This is occurring at the 12B6 stage. And so the types of evidentiary hurdles that they are now creating for patent owners to be able to successfully plead inducement are incredibly high, because the problem with indirect liability, both contributory and inducement, is that you often don't have all of this, the primary evidence that you need to obtain in order to show that they meet the requirements of the doctrine. You have some initial evidence, enough to indicate there's something going on here, because especially with inducement, because inducement, you're not even contributing a material contribution to the actual direct infringer. And so so typically it's internal emails, it's their freedom to operate searches and things of this sort, or the success of their freedom to operate searches, the type of evidence that you saw that was provided in Global Tech, where they said, yeah, this is willful blindness relying on Grokster, and by the way, it was notable for me in particular that Global Tech is completely absent in this opinion, except for citations to Global Tech for high-level doctrinal points, like the elements for proving inducement. But I think I'll leave it at there and kick it back to Wesley, and we'll have a fun discussion, and hopefully we'll get some good questions from the audience.
Well, yeah, two follow-up points. One, it's interesting you bring up the point about the freedom to operate opinions. I think that would be out under this new Supreme Court decisions, because that doesn't go to active intent. That just goes to the second element, knowledge. It's pretty clear, I think, under this opinion that knowledge, you can have as much knowledge as you want. It's really, you know, you have to have something that goes beyond. And Global Tech has other facts. I don't, you know, mean to imply otherwise, but the mere fact that you have knowledge that the there's going to be substantial infringing use is not going to be enough to get past the pleading standard on that third element of the inducement test. So that's one. And then the second thing is, you know, to go off your point about this being broader than skinny labeling, I think it's broader than patent law too, because the Supreme Court very clearly looked at both copyright and patent cases and drew parallels on the inducement standards, and the Federal Circuit's done the same thing. That's nothing new, but everything that's said in this opinion could be cited in any patent case. It's not any copyright case on inducement. I don't think that this case is limited even to patent law because of the way it's been presented.
I think that's exactly correct, I think. And by the way, it's the same. I mean, and it's very noticeable that they repeatedly cite Cox, their decision, right, this past April, on secondary liability for ISPs for copyright infringement. And that was also a unanimous, except there was a concurring opinion, just like in eBay, there were a couple of concurring opinions, but the core decision was unanimous and it was very short. And there are a lot of problems with the Cox opinion, just like there's a lot of concerns about this opinion, especially like there's citations to antitrust cases, like the A.B. Dick case from 1917 that are alleged to be indirect liability in patent law cases. In that case, they claim that intent, where the court crafts an intent requirement for indirect liability in copyright, and claims are getting it from copyright. And I'm sorry, but there isn't an intent requirement. There's a scienter requirement, especially in, there's no specific intent requirement. You don't have to have specific evidence of specific intent per se. So it's very notable that they, from my perspective, yes, they totally mucked up the doctrine of indirect liability in copyright law, and then they leveraged that in the follow-on case in ICMA to do something very similar in HIC for inducement liability in patent law. And in fact, that was told to them in oral argument. I mean, it's not surprising. ICMA's attorney, his opening line in the oral argument was, "You've already decided this case because in Cox." And the Supreme Court clearly agreed with him.
And one thing I'll say too about the, you know, mucking up doctrine and so forth, the vehicle of this case, whether true or not, I think the Supreme Court views it as a very clear case where there was a carve out. And this is not limited to skinny labeling. But the fact of the case is this carve out thing where you take one indication off your label and then they dismiss everything else as the FDA requires you to keep everything else in the label there. Well, that works, you know, somewhat when the method of use claims map on neatly to the indications. And sometimes that happens, but the patent office determines claims through prosecution completely separately from how the FDA determines approved indications. And these two things are happening in parallel. And obviously what the brand's goal is they want claims that map on neatly to the indications of their product, but you don't always know how it's going to work. The patent office may, you know, require certain amendments, or you might need to make the amendments to get past certain rejections. And so you can end up with claims as the brand that don't actually map perfectly to the indications and require other parts of the label. And so I think even in the generic Hatch-Waxman's context, this case is not going to be limited to skinny labels. It's now you're going to have cases where there's no carve out, but the generic's going to argue, well, you know, we didn't seek approval for the exact thing that is claimed in your patent. You know, that dependent element, some element of your claim requires looking at the clinical trial data or some other portion of the label. And we tried to carve that out, but the FDA told us no. And under this ICMA decision, you know, the Supreme Court, I don't think used the word immunize, but that's kind of the flavor of it that I took away from it, was that anything in the label that the statute is requiring that you include is not evidence of the intent of the generic applicant, because that's just what the statute requires. Really, the only thing I think that's left is the intent, the actual act of seeking approval for that particular indication. I think that is clearly an act that's left. But I'm curious, Adam, if you have any comments on what other acts you might be able to point to in these cases that would not fall within this potentially immunized category.
Yeah, so that's a great point, and it tracks a question that's been asked by John Delacorte of us perfectly. So where he says, in the view of the speakers, what short of a statement along the lines of you can use our generic for the patent indications too would constitute active inducement? Are there strategies that patent holders should pursue at the pleading stage? There was a perfect parallel thinking there as you were speaking. Because clearly what the Supreme Court is doing here is in a very short opinion, sub silentio, because he doesn't talk about any, throws out all of this case law that has been developed around what are the evidentiary requirements, right? What's the evidentiary baselines or standards for you to plead, not just plead, but pursue all the way through litigation, right? Inducement liability. Especially in the context of skinny labeling, but even more broadly. And they don't give any other indication other than, well, it has to be active. And this is one of the reasons why I think I mentioned Global Tech. And I think this might help going forward, because Global Tech is a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. They do cite it approvingly in the ICMA decision. It's a decision that the Supreme Court relied on Grokster. So you get reworking off of the copyright doctrine, as you see in ICMA as well, because ICMA relies significantly on Grokster, where they did find inducement liability. And from my perspective, the set of facts at a high level of generality are very similar to the types of activities that that HICMA engaged in this case, right? Because they, you know, the Supreme Court keeps saying, well, there are, these are just omissions, but they're, but no, you could read, you know, one person's omission is another person's activity to engage in an omission, right? They printed a label. They chose to print a label that that excluded the the CV limitation of use. They chose to include in their press releases data on sales that from our profits that covered infringing uses, right? So and this is what the willful blindness doctrine in Grokster was addressed, was so significant. And by the way, it's why Global Tech relied on Grokster in the patent law context, because you had the exact same type of activity resulting in omissions. So, I mean, and it's a great case. And so the CEO of Penta Alpha, his name is John Sham. You couldn't ask for a better name of a defendant, who deliberately purchased, it involved a patent on a deep fryer. A very successful deep fryer that was being sold in the United States. He purchased one that was made and sold outside the United States because they had no explicit statement from him on this, but the clear inference was he knew that it didn't have the patent marking on it. And that's what he gave to their supplier and manufacturer in Hong Kong and said, make this, make it identical, right? But you had no, you had no statements from him saying, I'm doing this specifically to avoid infringement, right? You just had him buying an external a fryer that didn't have the patent marking on it. He didn't tell the attorney for their supplier when they did their freedom to operate search that it was patented. And they had no direct evidence that he knew per se it was patented either. There was no smoking email that says, I know this is patented and I want to infringe it and I want to help them infringe it. So you have a lot of activities that, from my perspective, were very similar to the types of activities at a kind of a high level of generality that HICMA was engaging in, where they resulted in omissions, where there was always a plausible explanation, which is why in Global Tech, the court applies the willful blindness doctrine. And what you don't have discussed in this case is the willful blindness doctrine. So I think what you're going to have to start relying upon at the pleading stage is an assertion that, well, we don't have all the evidence yet, because what we have is a case of willful blindness, where they are actually engaging in activities to avoid knowledge. And we're not going to get the full evidence for that. We have enough evidence at this point to indicate that we think there is willful blindness, but we don't have the full evidence for it yet. And that we have to get through discovery, which is what you got in Grokster, and which is what you got in Global Tech, was you got to the discovery stage. So I think going forward, I think a good strategy might be to try to rely very heavily on Global Tech and the type of evidence that was allowed in there for proving willful blindness as a way at least to get past the 12B6 and at least to discovery.
Yeah. So one thing I think, you know, here that, you know, with what HICMA is doing, right, is they're seeking approval from the FDA of a particular product, and where it may be different in this context. And I would say that I certainly would expect patent owners outside the generic brand world to characterize this as just a skinny labeling case, right? Like that would be the most logical thing to do, whether that's right or not, and attempt to distinguish it. But I will say, like, it's notable HICMA did not challenge the knowledge element, right? They're not challenging the idea that they have knowledge of the the infringing uses, and there's a good reason for that. I mean,
they can, because they know, because it's
Panda, right? I want to be careful here, because not all cases are the same, but in a lot of generic drug situations, right, the generic drug is not, you know, communicating to the doctors or patients at all. And so that might be what's a little different from some of these other inducements outside of this context, less about skinny labeling and more about, like, what does that knowledge actually go to? The knowledge and willful blindness type evidence, when you're actually then sending it to someone to make the product or distribute it or use the product, is a little different in bridging that inferential gap than a generic drug company if they're knowledgeable, but they're not actually going to the doctor and saying, oh, come use this. It's that generic substitution, you know, by operation of law that, you know, just pops
exactly
the generic into the bottle when the doctor prescribed the brand for the the covered patented use.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so what I meant by the rely on the willful blindness doctrine and the evidence there is not, because that's a separate prong, is knowledge. Right. But to reframe that type of evidence that's been allowed for willful blindness as evidence of active inducement, because they were because they went together in those in global tech, the evidence of willful blindness was the evidence of also active induce that allowed was the activity then that indicated inducement. So so in global tech, you're right. The key here is, and this is the key in a lot of inducement cases, is that the party accused of inducement is oftentimes relying upon a professional context of knowledge that and knowledge of activities that are undertaken and assumed within the art in which they are working. Yeah. And so in this case, for instance, you know, Amarin argued, well, you know, Hickman knows that doctors will read the labels and they'll see, for instance, that there's evidence there about, you know, patients taking statins, and then that will prompt in them, oh, okay, well, this will also work for cardiovascular disease, right? And they know that because they're working within this field of art, and so this is how it works, right? And this is typically how it works in this context, and. This, the problem is that this is the evidence now that the Supreme Court has completely thrown out and said, yeah, well, that doesn't count at the 12B6 stage.
I think that's one area where the skinny labeling context, I think, does matter, especially mm-hmm. the Supreme Court, because I think on the other side of this, there's the answer or the issues that were raised with the GSK line of decisions, which is essentially I'm the generic and the law wants me to do these carve outs for whatever reason. Congress has adopted this as a public policy, and I've tried. If I could carve out the clinical trial data that you're citing as willful blindness in your complaint, I would do it, but the FDA won't let me do it. And I was struck by this line in the Supreme Court's in the Hickman decision talking about, we don't want to something like trench on commerce. I wish I had written it down verbatim, but it was so pragmatic in its understanding of, look, we just don't want this to upset the apple cart and result in too much, whatever that would be, you know, infringement liability or risk. And I would say that if you're a generic applicant, right, like your best bet is to actually try to carve all that stuff out and have the FDA affirmatively tell you no, so that you can then say, look, it's not me doing this. But I understand the point. Like there's going to be things in the label that say, do this, don't do this, or, you know, the statin piece from this case. And, you know, it seems like that's completely out from, you might have a different view. I'm viewing what the Supreme Court said is like, essentially that kind of thing, the argument that there's information in the label and that's enough is, you know, is not going to be enough if it's included as part of the label sameness requirement of the FDA regulations.
I agree with you. I mean, they're clearly making it very clear that the prior evidentiary standards that the Federal Circuit had developed for proving inducement in the context of skinny labeling are no longer acceptable. Not all is lost, but they don't tell us then what are the evidentiary standards,
right?
They just say it has to be active inducement. Well, used to be like your choice of how you wrote your label is an activity, is an active activity, right? You know, and you know, an omission by deliberate omission is an act in the law, generally is an activity, it's a positive action. So this then leaves, okay, well, then what other type of evidence can you rely on? And this is why I think, again, and I could be mistaken about this, but that global tech is helpful, because again, like one of the things that the Supreme Court emphasized was the context of knowledge of Sham. He was a patent owner. He had received patents. He knew patent law. So they were like saying, so like the fact that this is why his choice to purchase one of the patented fryers outside the United States because it didn't have the patent marking on it. They were like, that wasn't an accident. Now there was no, like I said, there was no smoking gun email that said, I'm doing this because I want one without a marking. But they were able to draw an inference from the fact that in his context, he had the knowledge. He knew what that meant. And I think, you know, you can now emphasize activities, but reframe them as they know what this means in the context of prescriptions by doctors, what doctors are looking at. I mean, they've been framing this in the context of labels up until now, but they'll have to rely on other evidence and other contextual evidence of the practices within the art. Now, the game is not over yet either. So the Supreme Court remanded, and what will hopefully potentially happen is on remand, the district court will dismiss without prejudice, which will allow then Ameren to refile, because one of the things that the Ameren made very clear in the oral argument was that the district court did not stay discovery during the appeal process from the 12B6 decision, and that they got additional evidence proving inducement during the discovery, which is exactly what you need discovery for. And so hopefully then what Ameren can do is refile with this additional evidence, overcome the application of the Twombly standard in this context, and then proceed forward on the type of evidence that the courts found completely acceptable in Grokster and in Global Tech on the basis of a full discovery and full litigation.
With that, I think we're at time.
Well, thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our panel for sharing their time and expertise with us, and I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.